This is the Who Wars Network. You have made the right choice.
Look out, this Rob and the team with the Who Wars podcast. The Alex and the Force, Blue Milk and Time Lords. It's the Who Wars podcast. It's the Who Wars podcast.
Hello there, and welcome to Who Wars, episode number 38. Wasn't that a formal intro? Why am I speaking like this? I don't know. Hello, welcome to the show. We really are the podcast, as you all know, for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who. And I'm your host, Rob Irwin. How are you? How's your week been? Mine was going along quite interestingly until it started to speed up, and then I suddenly realised we had a whole new Who Wars to put out. It's kind of funny, actually. We have 2 weeks between episodes, and the first week usually goes by pretty sedately, and then the second week starts, and I think, okay, we've got a week until the next episode, this is cool, and then all of a sudden, whoosh, and it's Saturday morning, and I've done the groceries, and I'm sitting here in front of the microphone thinking, oh my god, there's a whole show to produce. It's kind of fun. Speaking of fun, this is a fun episode. We've got a 40-minute interview with Matthew Jacobs, who I guess my Star Wars friends will know as, or I should say Lucasfilm friends will know as being the man behind some of the episodes of the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. He was also the writer on Star Wars Starfighter, one of the very first PS2 games. He's quite an interesting guy. He has a long history with working with Lucasfilm, with knowing George Lucas, and of course with Doctor Who as well, having written the TV movie from 1996. In fact, having been on the set of Doctor Who when he was a mere child, he met William Hartnell, the first Doctor, on the story The Gunfighters. His father was appearing in that episode as the Doc Holliday character, and oh gosh, there are so many anecdotes in this 40 minutes. It's really well worth listening to, whether you are a Star Wars fan or a Doctor Who fan. And did I mention he originally wrote Empire of the Sun, which became The Emperor's New Groove? There is a lot to dig through in that 40 minutes with Matthew Jacobs. It's really, really fun. Outside of that, we have some of our usual segments. I'm talking about the Clone Wars. We've got our comic reviews. We've got some book reviews and things. And people, I'm loving doing Who Wars, I really, really am, and I'd love to hear your feedback as to what you're enjoying yourselves, whether it's the features, the interviews, the ongoing reviews. What is it? Why not write in and let us know at hello@whowars.net, and we'll read you out on the show. In fact, if you send us an MP3, we'll just play you on the show. That's probably even easier. Baz Hood, where are you? We haven't heard from you for a week or two. Anyway, without any further ado, we try and keep these intros short, so there's just one last thing to mention, and that's Paul Cornell, Doctor Who writer, comics book writer, novelist. He's done it all. He talked to us a little while ago in our Phoenix Comic Con special and briefly mentioned the upcoming Titan Comics project, Four Doctors. It's a mini-series which, by its very name, has four Doctors from Doctor Who appearing in it. Think of other episodes like Five Doctors and Two Doctors and Three Doctors and so on, and it's in that sort of vein. Anyway, the first of those comics comes out on Wednesday, so only 3 days from now, and to celebrate, Andy has put together a written interview with Paul Cornell, which will appear on our blog, which is at whowars.net. I don't know whether some of you might listen to Who Wars exclusively through your media player or you go to the Podbean site, but at whowars.net we have all the episodes, plus we have a blog where we have some text-only stories, and this Paul Cornell interview will be there. So tune in or read in or whatever you do with a website on Wednesday, and you'll be able to see what Paul Cornell has to say about the Four Doctors comic. Okay, and that really is it for the intro. I hope you enjoy episode 38. You're more than welcome here at Who Wars. Let's get on with the show.
The Time Lord has 13 lives, and the Master had used all of his. But rules never meant much to him. So, I stowed his remains safely for the voyage back, because even in death I couldn't trust him.
Hmm. There. That should do it.
In all my travels through space and time, and nearing the end of my seventh life, I was finally beginning to realize that you could never be too careful.
It was a beautiful...
Whether you're Team Doctor Who or Team Star Wars, or you like them both, I have an interview I think everyone's going to enjoy. It's with Matthew Jacobs. Now, Doctor Who fans probably know him as the writer for the Eighth Doctor TV movie with Paul McGann, but he's done so much more than that, and he has some really interesting stories that you're going to get to hear all about. Now, just as a note, I noticed when I played this back, there's some weird echo reverb happening with some of my vocals, so I would just ask that you look past that, and I think that the interview really speaks for itself. Okay, so we have a lot to talk about. You've got Doctor Who and Star Wars connections.
Right. Deanna Jones.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And we'll talk about all of those. But first, I wanted to ask you about Emperor's New Groove.
Okay.
It's one of my favorite movies, and it's really popular with my generation. What was your inspiration for The Emperor's New Groove?
Well, the inspiration actually was shared with Roger Allers, who had directed The Lion King, and he'd been very successful with that in 1994, and I'd been very unsuccessful with my version of Lassie, but people still watch it, which had also come out the same year. He had seen the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. I really wanted to write a big animation film. And so basically we were put together, and the thing he wanted to do was a film. He basically held up a picture of Machu Picchu, and said, "This is what I want to do next." And we then developed this idea, which was then called Kingdom of the Sun. That was basically the same story. It covered a sort of spoiled emperor who gets turned into a llama and has to hack his way back to being a human by understanding the true meaning of friendship. And that arc was always there. Our version had all the basic characters, and a lot of the same elements and the same casting. And we worked on that for a few years and developed it as a musical with Sting, but then in the last couple of years, in the last year really, I think it got changed back into just being the drama of the transformation. So I think the inspiration for me, anyway, really came from a couple of movies that I love, which was sort of Jungle Book and Pinocchio, and certainly to a degree, The Prince and the Pauper. With the Prince and the Pauper element didn't really surface that much in the finished film, but it was something there a lot more in the earlier versions. These animated films, you know, they take years to develop, and they're very expensive. At least they certainly were then.
So it was really good at breaking down the fourth wall. Was that any of your doing, those scenes, you know, specifically where he's like talking to the audience and that kind of thing?
I'd love to say it was, but it's much more, I think the final team, Dave Reynolds, had that. I think always we always had David Spade, and David Spade has that tendency anyway. He has a very contemporary kind of cynicism to him and sarcasm, yeah. That was there. You know, I don't think on these films any one person can claim ownership. They're very much collaborative films, that's why, in the same way as sitcoms have that kind of punchiness, every line is really strong. But certainly, it's a film I'm very proud of. You know, I'm very proud of the fact that I'm just a part of it.
Awesome. Well, thanks for that. So this is a Star Wars and Doctor Who podcast, in case anybody forgot about that.
Right.
So let's get on to that. And let's start with the question, Star Wars or Doctor Who?
What do you mean?
Like, which one do you prefer? Which one's your favorite?
Oh, I have to say Doctor Who. I have to say Doctor Who at the end of the day. I mean, I love the Star Wars world. But my involvement in it is a little peripheral. I merely wrote one of the games, Star Wars Starfighter, and obviously I have a friendship and worked for a long time with George Lucas, so that was very, very important to me. But when it came to stuff that means more to me, it has to be Doctor Who. Doctor Who was part of my life, at least my conscious life, all the way from in 1963. And then when I got the opportunity to write and co-produce a new Doctor after it had been away, and try and set it up as an American show, it was like a dream come true. So that obviously means more to me.
So what is your first Doctor Who memory then?
Well, my first Doctor Who memory, I suppose, I've got vague memories of coming home and we would watch Doctor Who on a Saturday afternoon after doing the shopping, very much behind the sofa kind of memories where it was a pretty scary show. But one of my early memories, my dad was in it. My dad was played Doc Holliday in Gunfighters. And I was a very little boy then. And it was part of I don't know if I was that little. I think I was about nine. I don't know. Anyway, it was still William Hartnell. And, and my dad took me to the studio as a birthday treat. That was obviously, that's really ingrained quite vividly in my mind, you know, being there really with my two of my biggest heroes. That was my dad and that was the Doctor.
So what was the progression then, like from watching the show as a kid and then actually getting to do it as a career?
Do you want my biography? I think the thing is that you have a desire, certainly if you are in a family where the possibility of being involved in creating shows is there from the beginning. My dad was an actor. I think it was very early days, you know, when I was, 10, 11, 12, and I started out as a child actor. Even then, I was thinking to myself, wouldn't it be fantastic if one day I got involved in making these things? And the Doctor was certainly one of those things I imagined myself as being involved in. So I think the sort of you can say the bigger leap happened there when I was started to imagine that this thing could be a reality, could be a possibility. And once you've got that as a goal, then you just keep going toward it. I mean, that's just the way it works.
Okay, so let's talk about the movie then. So you wrote and co-produced the 1996 Doctor Who movie with the Eighth Doctor.
That's right, Paul McGann's Doctor.
Exactly. So what was your initial brief? And how was that different than the final broadcast?
My initial brief was to bring it to life as a TV movie that could be used as a backdoor pilot, which means that the film was being made by the TV movie division at Fox and not by the series division. And if it was very successful, then it stood a chance of being picked up, not only by Fox, but also by Universal, and made into a series. And when I was brought on after Philip Siegel had been trying for a couple of years, to set up a series at Universal. And he hadn't succeeded as the series, and the writers hadn't written anything, hadn't written stuff that pleased both the BBC and Universal or any of the people who were attached at that time. And so then they went to Fox, and at Fox, the head of TV movies was a man called Trevor Walton, who I knew from my time at the National Youth Theatre. We'd both been actors together, and we'd encountered each other at various times, and he knew of my work. Amblin, which was sort of peripherally involved, knew of my work. The BBC certainly did. I'd done a few things for them. The only people who didn't really know my work was Universal, even though they'd seen a bit of it via Young Indy. The door was fairly open. Basically, I got a call. How do you introduce Doctor Who to America in general, you know, to the larger American population? There was already quite a considerable fan following at that time. But, you know, putting it out on network TV meant, how do you do that? And so my original pitch, which was basically, Doctor Who am I? And the show basically being about the Doctor being regenerated in such a way as he can't remember who or what he is, and the show being about him trying to work out who he is, and only getting so far. That was the original pitch. And then it got built out into Doctor Who Am I? Once he finds out who he is, then he has to save the world. So I suppose the save the world part, the action part of it, was the bit that was a little different to the original pitch and the first couple of outlines and drafts that I did. First couple of outlines and drafts that I did were much more personal stories relating to the companions, and less of the sort of master complex plot stuff, though there was an element of that, obviously.
So were you involved in any further stories or outlines if it had turned into a pilot?
Well, it was regarded as a, like I said, a backdoor pilot. Mm-hmm. We didn't put together a Bible beyond the Bible that had already been written, but the Bible that had already been written would have been irrelevant. Everything kind of hinged on the viewing figures and the degree to which the two networks, network and production company and studio, really wanted to do it. So when we lost the night to Roseanne, we immediately knew we weren't going to be picked up. And BBC at that time didn't really value Doctor Who in the same way as they do now, or they did later in like 2004. At that time, in the early 90s, the BBC were pretty reluctant even to bring the Doctor back.
So have you kept up with any of the Paul McGann Eighth Doctor stories since then?
No, not really. Little bit here and there, but not really. I mean, after the show wasn't picked up, and there was a lot of blame thrown in my direction, not so much at Paul, even though I'd written his character and worked with him and everything like that. People basically said, you know, when they were finding fault with the show, they said the writing was at fault. And yes, it was a bit of a mix, and the second half of the film is a sort of a compromise between many different voices. So I felt a little distant from it and didn't want to go to conventions. So I backed away from that world, really. And also, I'd been doing a lot of big franchise stuff. So I was more interested in pursuing. That was around the time I was really working hard on Emperor's New Groove and on other stuff, you know. So I backed away from the world of Doctor Who. That was what happened. So as a result, even when the new show came out, I didn't really watch it until quite recently. Until suddenly they had the 50th celebration, and when the 8th Doctor was brought back for Night of the Doctor, I was really touched. I was really kind of pleased that Moffat had brought the Doctor back in, brought our Doctor, the 8th Doctor, back in such a sort of vivid and in a way, many ways, a very faithful way to the nature of Paul's Doctor. So at that point, I started getting interested again, and I caught up and watched shows and loved it.
Cool. So you wrote the movie in 1996. And then you didn't ever go to a con or anything like that until 2015, correct?
That's correct. And in 2015, I got invited after, in sort of like 2014, I was being invited to various things, but the main invitation had come from a tiny little rinky-dink convention in Jacksonville, Florida. Which ended up backfiring and becoming a mess, basically because the guy who was running it was kind of a little dubious, and he cancelled it and ran off with the money. And at that point, that was all over a certain section of the internet, and that was when Sean Lyon, who runs Gallifrey One, contacted me. I had not even really wanted to go to the Jacksonville one, but I've been making these small films recently. A couple of big animated films, but I've been primarily making these rather smaller films. And one of my collaborators, Vanessa Yule, who is a very good documentary filmmaker in her own right and works with me when I'm directing and acting. And we have, you know, we have a good, strong, creative relationship. She turned around and she said, "Matthew, there's a real documentary here to be made about you going back into a world." And I said, "Well, actually, I think there's a documentary here. It's really about the American fan of Doctor Who, and I've never seen a film that really goes into the nature of American fans and why Americans like the show."
So that brings us to the documentary, Doctor Who Am I?
Well, Doctor Who Am I, you know, that became, obviously, the title is loaded in all different ways. But it became basically one of those documentaries where I'm going on an adventure that's both a personal one, but primarily one of exploration, where I'm finding out about the nature of fandom. And so far, it's been quite a ride. It's really interesting. And the 5 days at the convention were fantastic. There were all sorts of interesting issues that were brought up during those days. We've been filming a little more that explores each of those issues. We've been cutting it. You know, it's hopefully we'll have the thing finished well before next year, or round about next year, which is the 20th anniversary of the TV movie.
Nice.
And we'll take it out. And our aim is to have an interesting feature film that speaks not just to Doctor Who fans, but to people who are interested in the amazing growth of the power of American fans. American fans are incredibly powerful at the moment, not just of Doctor Who, but all the other sci-fi and fantasy material that's out there.
So what do you think was your biggest revelation during this whole process?
Well, I'm not at the end of it yet.
Oh, okay.
There may be more, but certainly when I was in... and it was a revelation I should have seen coming anyway, I had been quite afraid of facing the music, as it were, going back to Gallifrey. And I had nothing to be afraid of. And, fans aren't going to trash you. They're fans, and they have interesting stuff to say that goes beyond the show. I think that was the biggest revelation, which is that really the show, these shows are catalysts for something bigger, something that's, you know, that is going on. People like to sort of gather together and exchange ideas. It's a community. And the shows themselves are the way in, you know, they're the pathway to a bigger thing, which is a sense of community and a bunch of ideas to a degree. I think with the Doctor, it's a sort of kind of a bit deeper than the Marvel characters. I think with the Doctor, because there's a question behind him, and there is an he does good, basically, and he regenerates. There's almost a sort of theological basis to his following that is probably more prevalent, I think, maybe, in America than it is in other countries like Korea, China, India, Australia, Britain, all the other places where Doctor is followed. I don't know for sure, but I certainly know that when I wrote the movie and I said that he was half human, it's like I was committing sacrilege.
So how can fans support the movie?
With Doctor Who Am I, we have a website, which is doctorwhoamI.com, and we have a Twitter page. As we get closer to completing the movie, we're going to amp up the social media in a big way, try and create a following. We may find that there's an area of production that we need help with. We may find that there's that we might be using the social media platforms as a way of distributing the film, or giving people early access to it. I don't know. Basically, that's something that might be in the hands of the distributors more than us, and also depends a lot on how the movie turns out. But people can support the movie by talking about it. And we're certainly going to be putting something out in the next couple of months in the way of a teaser, like a sizzle reel. We're going to start putting stuff out there so that people start getting aware of the film.
Okay, awesome. It sounds really interesting.
Hopefully it is. And because the film... You know, there will be some Doctor Who stars involved in it, but the film is primarily about the fans. There are like star fans. There are like people who are like number one fans for whatever reason there are. But there are also, you know, the regular fans, and there are people who are just followers of the show. It's really about them. That's why it's called an intimate portrait of the American fan. It's about me getting to know a whole bunch of people, and them. They kind of take over the story at the moment, which is good. Which is the way it should go.
Cool. All right. So. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about your Star Wars and Lucasfilm connections.
Okay.
All right, so you wrote for the game Starfighter.
Yes.
How is writing for a game different than other forms of media?
Certainly with Star Wars Starfighter, it was one of the first, if not the first, I don't know for sure, PlayStation 2 game. It was certainly the first PlayStation 2 game that LucasArts had put together. And we only ended up using a fraction of the power of PlayStation 2 for budgetary reasons. It was a non-linear narrative. We followed the different characters. You could go in one direction, you could go in another direction. The various narratives did come together, but the possibility, the potential for a non-linear narrative is the thing that attracted me to writing for games. I'd written one game prior to that, which was Outlaws, which is a shoot 'em up, first person shoot 'em up Western. The reason I got put on these games was not because I'm a games expert or was a games expert then, was simply because George wasn't happy with the level of the dialogue and some of the characterization that was coming out of LucasArts at that time. And so Rick McCallum and George contacted me and said, would I be interested in basically coming on board and amping up the characters and working with LucasArts. And I worked with Darren Stinnett, who was the main guy who created both those games. And we built out the characters, and certainly I wrote the screenplays.
Okay, so can we go back to George Lucas?
Yeah.
Do you have any good stories about him?
Well, obviously, he was a hero of mine. I got to meet, the first time I met him was when I was put up to work on Young Indiana Jones. Young Indiana Jones, when it was originally conceived, was an educational thing, which is how it ended up, even though they knew it was going to be an ABC TV show. His long-term aim was to have 72 hours of documentaries, and that's what he delivered at the end of the day. That's what you can get now on the DVDs. And so he's a very determined soul. He wanted to have writer-directors, and I was writing and directing at that time, and so was, you know, Frank Darabont already, so was Hensley, and so was John Hales, and, you know, we were all filmmakers as well as writers. So we got it. So he was in London. I got invited to, you know, to pitch to do the job. And he was staying at the St. James Club, which is a very small club in the middle of London. And I got there for the meeting, and he was down in the lobby. He'd just come back from lunch with Rick McCallum. Now, the elevator in the club was tiny. So the first time I meet this hero of mine, I'm right face to face with him. You know what I'm saying? It was like very uncomfortable. And we get to the top. He probably doesn't remember. We get to the top. And you know, and his favorite, the film of his that I actually love the most is American Graffiti.
Oh, that's a good one.
which is, you know, so we got on straight away because I saw American Graffiti very much as a version of Midsummer Night's Dream. And he was interested in that. So, you know, he's an incredibly smart man. He's very, very smart, and he has his own way of making films. And so we hit it off quite quickly. But then, you know, the other thing that he was really enthusiastic about having writers at the ranch. And so it was incredibly welcoming. We had a writer's building, and you know, like half of us were British and smoked cigarettes, which now you would never do it. But if you can imagine, he allowed us in his office at the top of Skywalker. We were all puffing away. And the rest of the ranch were going, oh my God, we'll need to rebuild this place. So there, I have a memory of that. We took quite a lot of liberties, really. It was enormous fun. You'd work through a day, we're sort of with all the research around a subject. Because if you think about Indiana Jones, even the initial story is always based on a what if, sort of what if the Nazis actually pulled up the Ark of the Covenant. It's something they were looking for, according to history. What if Indiana Jones was there? So that what if applied to historical research was just enormous fun. We'd spend a couple of days exploring that, and then we'd thrash out the story all together. And then at the end of 2 weeks, we would sort out who was going to write what. Then we'd go away, we'd write the shows, we'd come back, we'd do a session again where we all gave notes, go away, do the revisions. Directors were then hired, star directors from various countries where it was being shot. And then he still included us with the directors, and we'd be talking to the directors and him. He really treasures writing. Treasures writers. And so for me, it was like a tremendous baptism into American culture. And it was around that time that I moved from London and came and lived in the Bay Area and in LA and got my green card, and I've been here ever since.
So with young Indiana Jones, what was that like? Or what was the process of writing for the younger character of Indiana Jones?
Well, we had two younger characters. We ran two storylines. One was the young Indiana Jones, who's about 10 years old, and he's going on a trip with his parents around the world, and he meets all these incredible people. And then the older one, who goes off on a spring break adventure and it ends up, signing up for World War I, becomes a soldier, goes from being a sort of gung-ho hero to being a secret agent whose objective is to bring peace after he meets Albert Schweitzer. And then after that, the war ends and he's involved in all sorts of adventures, Broadway, Hollywood, gangsters, the whole lot. So the two different ages were, you would go between the two, and they would be kind of different stories. The younger young Indy was normally very basic stuff, very basic, first time he kind of has a crush, falls in love with Princess Sophie, the daughter of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. And that was one I wrote that was also about psychiatry. He ends up at a dinner table with Freud, Jung, Adler, and of course his father, who believes in, chivalric love. And he's trying to find out what is love. Very much TV, but we had Max von Sydow. We had like the it was being directed.
Oh, he's in the new Star Wars movie, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. So that was the joy, was we could bring anyone to the table. Dealing with Indy as a younger character. The problem is the character's going to survive. Any kind of prequel where people are going to survive takes some of the tension out of an action movie. Right.
So I was thinking there's the new Star Wars anthology that's coming out about Han Solo when he was younger.
Yes.
Do you have any advice for the writers of that to make that movie a success?
Well, God knows what advice I could give. The only thing I think about prequels and sequels and all of this is there's a tendency to say, wouldn't it be great if we understood this or understood that or went deeper with this or went deeper with that? But when they do it, really all they're doing is taking some of the mystery out of projects, that out of ideas, out of worlds, and that mystery is in of itself one of the elements that makes the world so compelling. When they tried to explain the Force or explain what was really going on behind the Matrix, whenever these mysteries are explained, people who follow the show, some of the mystery, some of the enigma goes from it. So that, if I had to give any advice, And they certainly wouldn't ask me. It would be don't explain anything. Create more mysteries. Create more compelling things that will engage the audience. They did it well when they brought back the most recent run of films on Star Trek. I think that was done well. There was a boldness to it that was fresh. I'm hoping they do the same with the new Star Wars. Certainly people's expectations are very high at the moment. It's a bit like Christmas. There will be tears. I'll certainly be there.
Awesome. So I just have like one last general question about Star Wars. Where would you like to see the franchise in general? What direction would you like to see it head?
Gosh, that's a really hard question. it's a good question. Where would I like to see it head? What was interesting about what George was trying to do with the prequels was he was exploring, I think, early 20th century politics, the growth of imperialism. And one of the things about Star Wars is it has spearheaded, if you like, philosophical perspectives and in the first three that we saw, and in, you know, by using the hero's journey, by using the history of mythology, and in the second three, as far as I saw, it was exploring more political perspectives.
Yeah.
Now, the political perspectives weren't as appealing because everybody was looking for the philosophical action stuff. We can say general people were a little negative toward that. They were a little negative toward it when it shifted across to the sort of political imperialist intrigue, which was people walking around talking. And of course there was the birth of, you know, there was Anakin and the build of all that, but that we knew where that was going. So it didn't have that much tension. Now, what I think could be really exciting is if it becomes a combination of the both, a punch to it in the same way, I suppose, Mad Max has this kind of dystopian focus, the original one does. If it was a bit braver, the thing that I love about Star Wars is the samurai, the Western kind of aspect. I like the action. I like the irreverence of Han Solo. I like the boldness of the alien characters. I think there's a real opportunity because they can do whatever they want, and I think the braver they are with the franchise, the better it's going to be. People want to be amazed. People want to see stuff that's fresh and original. That was the wonderful quality of the early Star Wars science fiction. Apart from 2001, science fiction was regarded as a subgenre, and Star Wars made it into a main genre. Now let's make it into something better, even more exciting.
That was an awesome answer. Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to Who Wars.
Okay. Thank you so much for interviewing me. Seriously, yeah. It's always nice. And, you know, and I want people to look out for Doctor Who Am I. I think yes. It's going to be something people will want to see.
Do you want to tell people one more time, like, where they can find you and all that stuff?
DoctorWhoAmI.com. Just those words all run together, and look for it on Twitter and look for its Facebook page. It won't be hard to find. Participate. We ask questions all the time. There's a piece up at the moment about the question of is Doctor Who a religion? PBS did a great little piece on that. And I want to engage people in debates. If there are fans who are really interesting in the LA, in the San Francisco area, we're going to come out and we're going to interview you if you've got something to say. So, you know, do that.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Allons-y, and may the force be with you.
You too.
For so many of us, Star Wars ignites our imagination like no other. So when we heard the news that Lucasfilm is rumored to be in talks with Netflix for multiple TV shows, a lot of us got really excited. And so I decided to have a little bit of fun and ask the Who Wars team, as well as Twitter, for their ideas about what Star Wars shows they'd like to see. So I'll start off with the Who Wars team. First up, Andy.
Hello, hello, hello! So, TV programs that I think should be on Netflix with the Star Wars theme. First of all, we've got High School Antics at Naboo High School. We've got the Sassy Handmaidens, we've got the Cool Guard Cadets, and of course we've got Lovable Geek, Mr. Jar Jar Binks, Mr. Didn't Mean to Flood the Toilets. That's going to be called Saved by Rebel. And then of course if Netflix wants to talk to me and Kate about getting the rights to our adventures with Vader and Aphra, we could have an Empire-based drama called Bad Men, yeah? And then we could have a military-based show set in the Rebel Hangars about recruiting Imperials to be Rebel pilots. That's going to be called Orange is the New Black. And then finally, I thought we could have a look at a group of people applying to be a new Sith Lord for the Emperor. We could call that The Apprentice. But on a more serious note, there's only two series, I think. Well, I'd like to see loads of series, but the two that I'd really like to see, one would definitely be The Adventures of Obi-Wan once he's on Tatooine, what he gets up to, because I think he's a great character. There's a lot to explore, and I think he got up to all sorts of mischief there on Tatooine before he went off with Luke in episode 4. Then the other thing I'd like to see is the sort of version of the Knights of the Old Republic. So we're sort of going back to a more Game of Thronesy type of atmosphere. Going back further in Star Wars history than they've ever gone in the films and animations. I'd love to see that sort of a lot more noble kind of Jedi and different kind of fight going on. Anyway, that's me.
Good stuff, Andy. And funny you should mention Aphra, because she is my number one choice for a live-action Star Wars show. I think she's been a very popular character, and she would translate really well into a serial format like that. And yeah, I would just love to see that. All right, let's move on to Alan.
If Star Wars were to make an appearance regularly on Netflix, there's a couple of shows I wouldn't mind seeing. I'm a big fan, or was a big fan, of the idea of Star Wars Detours. I know there's going to be a few people listening to me just going, no way. But really, I enjoyed the idea of having a comedy Star Wars show. So that's actually one of my first requests, is if Star Wars, if Lucasfilm Star Wars was to put something on Netflix, I would like them to actually take the Seth Green ideas and start doing a long-running show on Netflix for the Star Wars Detours. I know they've got a lot of episodes done. Would love to hear it on there. So that would be my number one choice. Beyond that, I would be interested in centralized stories around the galaxy. It doesn't have to be a big space odyssey. Something maybe on Coruscant. Maybe you have a series taking place on Coruscant around particular characters that we haven't seen make it into canon yet. I would love to see more of the bar scenes, or even the underground, underground community on Coruscant, and where all the bounty hunters go, and some of the underground situations that happen there. I think it'd be great to do something that way that might be a little more dark, might be a little more mature audience-wise, not something necessarily for the movies. Beyond that, I find it hard trying to decide whether there's anything I'd love to see in a Netflix TV-like series that doesn't cross over into some of the characters, both from the movies and books that we don't already know. I'd have a hard time seeing Luke, Leia, and you know, any of the Jedi we're used to, Boba, on a regular basis on a TV series, live-action series, because we've already seen them in Clone Wars, we've already seen them in Rebels, you know, things like that. I think a live-action series would be better suited covering some of the unknowns, some of the more centralized, you know, specific locations like what I mentioned. Those are just some of the thoughts I have. Would love to see those things happen on Netflix. Definitely, definitely Star Wars Detours.
Thanks, Alan. I didn't even think of Star Wars Detours. That would be pretty interesting to see on Netflix. All right, so let's move on and hear what Rob had to say.
You know, for me, Kate, the answer to this question is an oldie but a goodie, and that's back in the days of the Extended Universe novels for Star Wars, back in the days when the Extended Universe was still relatively new. I had a real thing for the X-Wing series, largely written by Michael Stackpole, but the late, great Aaron Alston also wrote a few of the novels as well. And my overriding feeling when I was reading those novels, even when I was reading the first one, let alone the second, third, fourth, or fifth one, there were even more beyond that, my overriding feeling was, gosh, this would be a great TV series, because the adventures they were on felt very episodic. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think Michael Stackpole was even thinking of particular TV actors at the time when he was casting the pilots of the squadron. In his head, he'd think, oh, I'm going to write this character like, you know, such and such on such and such TV show. So there was even a sense of casting from the TV of the time when X-Wing, the series, was being written. And I still today think it would be a great thing. Obviously not the same stories. The EU is now Legends, and already from what we know of Aftermath and so on, the story of what happens in the Star Wars universe is probably going to be a little different to what happened in the X-Wing novels. In the X-Wing novels, it's probably no spoiler to say that a large part of the early ones is the liberation of Coruscant, for example. But obviously that would have to be changed in a modern X-Wing series. But I still think the concept of a squadron and a range of pilots would give you such scope for a TV series in terms of the missions they're doing, in terms of the stories you can tell. Even if you think of the squadrons of Viper pilots in Battlestar Galactica, the focus of the show wasn't even on the squadron. But even that gives you a taste of what an X-Wing series could have been like. So that's my vote. I would love if there was a X-Wing Squadron sort of series on Netflix or something like that.
I think you're on to something there, Rob. I feel like this is one of the more likely ideas that they would go with, and it could tie in really nicely with Rogue One. So I think maybe we could possibly see something like this coming up. Okay, so thank you, Who Wars team, for your awesome answers. Now, I'm going to go and read you off some of my hilarious responses that I've been getting on Twitter. So, first up, I've got at Peter DeChico. He says, I've said it before and I'll say it again. I need to see a show about the handmaidens being badasses. Also, a Freaks and Geeks style high school comedy about dorky Luke Skywalker and his cool best friend Biggs Darklighter. Alright, so those are some good ideas there. I think I would watch both of those shows. Alright, we've got at Across the Stars. If there were to be a CG series, I'd like to see what Ahsoka was up to before Rebels. Yes, I would too. Alright, at Brush Your Teeth. A show about the Rule of Two, and each season would have a new master and or apprentice, and by doing that you'd be able to cover a lot of time. That's an interesting concept. I think that could work. Alright, now, at Joaquin Slowly, he says, Kenobi or Boba Fett series done as a modern space western. Justified meets Longmire meets Firefly in a Star Wars setting. Very cool. Alright, at Darth Kindness, he says, I'm thinking with my grandpa hat on here. I would love to see the Ewoks and Droids cartoons make it on there. New stuff? Obi. Thanks for that, Darth Kindness. Now, Werewolf Cowgirl, could we have a Teen Leia story of her in the Junior Senate and her political activism? I like that idea. I think that would be amazing. Okay. Now, at Force Children, I had posted a picture of Dex and Obi-Wan, and so he was kind of responding to that, and he said, yes, this is my suggestion for the Star Wars show I want to see on Netflix. It's like Seinfeld, but in space. Dexfield. So that's pretty awesome. I had so much fun asking this to everybody, so thanks again for everyone who responded. Hopefully, we'll be able to binge watch some of these shows in no time at all.
Brace yourselves, listeners, for a segment 7 years in the making. Right now, and for many episodes to come, Rob is watching the Clone Wars.
Yes, folks, here I am to look at another episode of the Clone Wars, and it is just one episode today. Last time I looked at three episodes. This time around, it's just the one episode. I'm looking at a season one story called Rookies. Now, Rookies is the fifth episode of season one, and it first aired back in October of 2008. Now, the official description of the story runs along the lines of, alone on a distant outpost, Commander Cody and clone Captain Rex must inspire the rookie clones to believe in themselves to stave off a commando droid invasion. And I guess by looking at that official description, you think, oh no, it's one of these believe in yourself kind of things. Oh God, no, no, no. You know, this is the kind of inspiring go get 'em stuff that, you know, does tend to just annoy me in children's TV programming. But Rookies doesn't really go along those lines. Although that's a reasonable description of what happens, it's not the kind of cheesy, believe in yourself and anything is possible kind of, you know, nonsense that you do see in entertainment. To put it another way, I actually really liked Rookies. And from the get-go, you have these guys on an outpost, these fairly new clones, although they have a more experienced sergeant with them, and you can sort of tell that by the way he has grey on his temples and greying eyebrows even. That's a very subtle way of showing that he is an older clone with them. And they're out there on this remote outpost, they're listening to the radio, there's, you know, very subtly some girly posters on the walls behind them, and they're complaining of how boring it is, but as their sergeant points out, they are the outpost that stands between any kind of invasion and Kamino, where the rest of the clones are being bred. You know, it's their home, essentially. They are protecting it. So it is a fairly important assignment, even if it is boring at times. And into this environment comes a small invasion. Well, it's not really an invasion, a small infiltration, I guess you could say, of battle droids, but these just aren't any battle droids. They're kind of a commando version of battle droids. They've got darker armor. They do seem a little bit more intelligent, although not much more intelligent. And they infiltrate the base. And this was quite interesting because the first clone they take out, they appeared to electrocute, maybe stun, and sort of drag him away very quietly. And I thought, oh yeah, that's in keeping with, you know, a kid's show. You're not going to, you know, execute people. But then the next person they come across is the sergeant on the base, and they actually knock him down, and three of them blast into him mercilessly with their laser pistols. So they absolutely execute the next clone they come across. I thought, oh gosh, these guys are playing for keeps. And then we have this story unfold where the rookie clones are hiding from the infiltration team. They're out on the planet, you know, because they've had to flee from their base. There's these big eels, these big worm type things. It's like something out of Dune on the planet. And one of them gets eaten by one of these eels. So again, not quite kiddie fair. And then, of course, we have Commander Cody and Captain Rex turn up, and they help turn the tide against these infiltrated droids. And in the end, though, it's one of the Rookies who ultimately saves the day. I'm sure you've seen it. I'm sure you'll know whether you liked it or not. For me, again, it was a real surprise packet. I was expecting something a bit more cheesy, but this was fairly gritty. This was fairly visceral, and although I guess, you know, one clone giving up his life to blow up the base, you know, I can't do it remotely, I've got to do it manually, or whatever his line was, is a tiny bit cliche, it was still a really, really good episode overall, and I'd have no hesitation in giving it an 8 out of 10, and on the kiddie scale that we've spoken about in past reviews of Clone Wars, I don't think it was very kiddie at all. I think it was fairly, you know, adult, or at least watchable by an adult. The only remotely kiddie stuff is the way the battle droids behave, but that is standard for battle droids, so, you know, you can't really complain too much about, you know, the Roger Rogers and, you know, the slight stupidity that they go on with. Also nice to see General Grievous in the episode as well, not in the infiltration team itself, but behind the infiltration, and a small cameo by Asajj Ventress as well. So, look, overall, I really, really like this. What did you think of it? You know, if you've seen it, why not write in and let me know at hello@whowars.net. You can even record yourself as an MP3 and talk about any aspects I might have glossed over here or anything that you particularly liked or didn't like about this episode. I know there are some real Captain Rex fans out there, and obviously Rex is turning up again in Star Wars Rebels as a much older man, so this is kind of one of the big debut stories, I guess, for him, introducing him to us as the audience. And I guess there's a lot in here that will go on, you know. Obviously, Commander Cody will go on to do other things, and these clones getting taken into the 501st Legion at the very end of the story is all part of a bigger picture, I'm sure. So yeah, let me know what you thought and what you liked about this episode or didn't like, and we'll use it on an upcoming show. Thanks everyone for listening. I know next time around we might be looking at 2 or 3 episodes of The Clone Wars, so if you're trying to keep up with us, do watch the next few episodes, and you'll be able to hear more from me in 2 weeks' time. I'll see you then. You know, I don't know if you out there as the listener make your own podcast. I know a lot of podcasters listen to other podcasts, so it's entirely possible that you are a podcaster as well. And I don't know if you have this experience, but in making Who Wars, I, you know, produce an episode and I put it out and I think, gosh, that was really quite good. There was a great article on this and there was a great interview on that. And wow, will we ever top that? And it seems that magically, every episode or two, we do manage to top ourselves. And you would have heard, here's a good example, you would have heard recently in episode 36 when I absolutely raved, hey, we've got our first Doctor from Doctor Who on the podcast. And that was Colin Baker speaking with Andy. And I thought that was the most amazing thing ever. Well, here we're about to hear from Colin Baker again, plus Sylvester McCoy, the 7th Doctor, plus Sophie Aldred, who played Ace, you know, companion of the 7th Doctor. And so we've just topped ourselves already. And you might be wondering how this came about, and that's very important for me to mention here. Andy, who contributes a lot to Who Wars, has started his own podcast, a pop culture podcast called Top Geek. Now, you can hear that at topgeek.podbean.com. And geek, it's important, is spelled G-E-A-K. And you can also find it on facebook.com/pages/topgeek, which is hyphenated there. So do look up Top Geek. And for the first episode of Top Geek, Andy got Elizabeth Carter, who you will have heard before on Who Wars. Funnily enough, on the same episode we had Colin Baker on, because she was cosplaying at the Hull Comic Con. And Andy got chatting with her, and she's now contributing to Top Geek and by association Who Wars. And at another recent comic event, she spoke to Colin Baker, Sylvester McCoy, and Sophie Aldred, and Andy very kindly has loaned me the audio to play here as well. It's a slightly trimmed down version of what you'd hear on Top Geek, so do go there for the full Monty, as it were. There's a whole section on one of the cast members of A Town Called Mercy, which I've cut out from here, so if you want to hear from him, definitely go to Top Geek, plus a few other little trims here and there. So the original is still at Top Geek. Please listen to it there. But for a taste of Elizabeth talking to the Sixth Doctor, the Seventh Doctor, and Ace, let's hit it.
Guys, I'm here with Colin Baker, who is best known for portraying the Sixth Doctor in Doctor Who, so hello.
Hello, young lady.
Hello. So, I'm going to ask you a few questions, if that's okay. So, your costume, which is considered to be very similar to Joseph and the Technicolor Amazing Dreamcoat, you apparently wanted the costume to be more like the Ninth Doctor's costume, a bit more darker, apparently. What was your thoughts on the costume originally?
Well, I was asked what I would like to wear, and what I described is more or less what Christopher Eccleston got all those years later. Because I always thought the Doctor would probably, given his lifestyle, want to be a little unobtrusive at times and disappear into the background elegantly. So what I got was an explosion in a rainbow factory. But you have to bear in mind it was the 1980s when, you know, glam rock and the new romantics were around. So it's very much a costume of its time. And I have to say, you are talking to me wearing a cricket costume and a stick of celery, so you can't talk.
So out of all the stories that you've portrayed the Doctor as, what has to be your favourite story and why?
Well, I suppose because of working with dear Patrick Troughton, it would have to be Two Doctors, because he was a brilliant actor, and without him we wouldn't be here, because his first regeneration is the one that made it possible for the rest of us. So working with him on Two Doctors was fabulous.
So speaking of the topic of cosplayers, when you see someone cosplaying your Doctor, how does it make you feel?
It makes me feel that they must be mad, because I know how much money it must cost them to cosplay as my Doctor.
It's quite a lot.
And amazingly, there are quite a lot of people who do. I think they see it as a challenge. But I'm quite flattered, of course I am.
So have you been watching the new series then, since it came back?
Yeah, I watched most of David and Matt. And I started watching Peter, but I've got about 10 of them now on my hard disk. I haven't had a chance to watch. So I've got to catch up on Peter. But I saw his first two episodes. I thought he was fantastic.
That's all we've got time for, but thank you very much for having me too.
A very great pleasure. Nice talking to you.
Hello, guys, and I'm here with the very lovely Sophie Alred today.
Hi, guys.
When Doctor Who was axed back in 1989,
yes.
Apparently there was supposed to be a narrative about Ace going to Gallifrey and becoming a Time Lord. What were your thoughts on that originally?
I'd love to her to have done that. I think she would have been so brilliant for the Time Lords. She would have she'd have really put the wind up them. And, you know, can you imagine Ace on Gallifrey with Nitro 9 and the baseball bat? Yeah.
Was you quite disappointed then with the fact that they axed the show and everything and you wanted to do that?
Yeah, I was really upset. Really, because I just loved working on the show so much. It was great to work with Sylvester, and also I learnt everything I knew about acting on TV from that show. So yeah, it was a real shame when it finished. I was gutted.
If you were able to come back, would you love them to do that narrative perhaps, if they ever...
That would be great. Yeah, I'd love them to do that. I mean, although I'm just intrigued by, say, somebody like Stephen Moffat, you know, what he would think for Ace, you know, to do. I know that Russell T. Davies had this idea that she was working for a thing called a Charitable Earth, and that would be interesting to explore as well. I mean, we did do the Gallifrey theme in the Big Finish audios, which is interesting, you know. So, but yeah, I'd love to do that.
Apparently, you were meant to appear in the Sarah Jane Adventures. I don't know, is that true?
Yeah, that's right. I was told that Russell T. Davies had an idea that Ace was going to be appearing with Sarah Jane in one of the stories, and you know, I just really regret the fact that I never got to work with Liz, because I knew her so well from conventions, and what a lovely woman. It would have been just great to work with her.
It's such a shame about her passing, because I thought she was brilliant. never met a Star Wars, but she's one of the companions that I really wanted to meet.
Yeah, she was a lovely woman.
Such a shame. But while we're here, we definitely have to speak about that scene in Remembrance of the Daleks.
Oh yeah, that one.
For you, how was that for you in terms of like filming? Did you actually have a stunt double for that scene that shot where you actually jumped through the window? Was that you?
The actual jump through the window was a stunt double, because it was my first big stunt, and on the other side of that window was pretty much a wall, so they were worried that if I jumped through I might sort of splat cartoon-like against the wall, you know. But the rest of it I did, and it was great, although I knew that I only had one chance to do it. So it was quite stressful in that, you know, I had to get it right first time. But it was just awesome to beat up a Dalek with a baseball bat.
I think you can definitely be really proud saying I was the companion that beat up a Dalek, you know,
exactly,
compared to any of the others. So you worked on CBeebies, animated series called Tree from the Top, which actually you worked alongside Peter Tomlin.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
What was that like working with him?
Oh, it was wonderful, because I'd worked with him before on a Big Finish audio called Coldix, before he did Doctor Who. So it was lovely to meet up with him again, and he's just the most lovely, brilliant guy. He's also so talented. I mean, it's great fun to work with. We had a blast doing that. And I'm still doing Truth with Tom, actually. We've got another series we're doing. But David just, he couldn't fit it into his schedule. He was just so busy.
So if you had to describe Ace in one word, what would that be?
Oh, wicked.
That's awesome. So out of working with what's the most iconic moment ever?
The most
iconic moment?
On Doctor Who?
Yeah.
Working with Sylvester, beating up the Dalek with a baseball bat, and I think working with so many luminaries from the theatre world, you know, and film and TV, all sort of Dinsdale Landon, Sylvia Sims, Anne Reed, I mean, the list is endless, and I learnt so much from all those talented people, Sheila Hancock, I mean, everybody. And I just think the fun of it, the joy of every moment of working on that, you know, it's great.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks.
What are you wearing?
So I'm here at Manchester Comic Con with the amazing Sylvester McCoy. Thank you very much for letting me meet you.
It is my pleasure.
For those people who haven't seen your Doctor, which if they haven't, then they definitely should, how would you describe him?
My Doctor? Well, he's kind of a mixture of clown, but that's a front, and behind it is a very serious and calculating and manipulative man.
Now the explosion scene in The Bridge of the Galaxy.
Yeah. Well, it was the very last scene of the day, of the very last scene of the whole story. It was, we had to get it in before 6 o'clock. The sun was going down, so it had to be done in a one go. Now, I looked into the tent, and I said, what are those big things there? And they said, oh, that's just, there'll be rubbish and it'll blow out behind you. Yeah. And as I walked past, the whole Second World War took off. And there was heat everywhere, and I didn't know whether my clothes were burnt or singed, but I knew that I couldn't do anything but carry on, because it was the last shot of the day. It might have been the last shot of my life.
So, 5-ish Doctor's reboot. Apparently, you didn't get paid for that.
Oh no! Yeah, the Doctor's reboot. We did it for love, and not for money. We did it for love. We did it for the fans. We did it for the love of the program that we loved, and for the fans who we loved. And we knew they loved the program, and they knew that they wanted us to be in the 50th anniversary, but we knew we weren't. And all the people that volunteered to do it for no money. Sadly, if we were going to make another one, you couldn't ask people to do it for nothing again. I mean, Ian McKellen, he'd cost $20 million. And goodness knows what Peter Jackson would cost. Zillions.
Finish.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about in the future?
Well, there's a whole pile, really. I just finished doing one yesterday. Yeah, yesterday, and then Sophie and I did Tuesday and Thursday. We did. I can't tell you what they are because you've got to listen. But there are more coming out. There's more of Bernie Summerfield ones that I'm doing. Kind of they carry on, which is lovely. I love doing them.
Have you got any future projects coming out?
Yes, I'm off to India. But I can't really talk about it, really. I'm off to India with Miriam Margolis.
Oh, and he was never seen again.
Yes.
That's all we've got time for, but thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
My sincere thanks there to Elizabeth for conducting those interviews with the Sixth Doctor, the Seventh Doctor, and Ace. Just brilliant. If you'd like to communicate more with Elizabeth on Twitter, for example, she is at E. Gunhild Carter. That's E-G-U-N-H-I-L-D Carter, C-A-R-T-E-R. And I'm sure she'd love to hear from you. She'd love to hear what you thought of her interviewing here. Also, again, warm thanks to Andy for loaning me the audio from Top Geek to put in here in the Who Wars podcast. Just great stuff. I love the way there's a group of podcasts out there. I would think of ourselves and Top Geek and Diddly Dumb and 42 to Doomsday and the Blue Box podcast and some others who are very friendly, collaborative. We love to share where we can, if not content, then at least personnel to appear on each other's programs. It's really healthy. There's not a whiff of competition amongst this group I'm thinking of, and long may that continue.
Sir, permission to express my opposition to your current apathy.
Permission granted.
Sir, I am opposed to your current apathy.
The Doctor, His Lives and Times is a hardcover Doctor Who reference book that came out in 2013. And you might be thinking to yourself, Rob, why are you talking about a book that came out in 2013? And that's a good question. Look, very simply, this book popped up at a discount bookstore near me recently. It's a book that I hadn't bought when it was new around the time of the 50th anniversary for Doctor Who. It was a book I probably wouldn't have bought around that time even if I'd seen it in stores, because books of this nature, large coffee table type books, hardback in Australia, usually $40-$50 a pop, and for the kind of information in them, they're just not worth it to me. However, when a book like this pops up at $10 in a discount store, it makes a lot of sense. So I don't know whether these are being dumped on discount stores around the world or whether you may be lucky and find one second hand. But I thought, hey, I think I'll review this because there is a lot of interesting stuff in here. But before I get to the book, I do want to say something. When I was a kid, and it seems a lot of my Doctor Who stories relate to, when I was a kid, I loved a particular Doctor Who reference book. It was by Peter Haining, and it was called Doctor Who, A Celebration. I would have taken that book out of the local library more times than I can count. And in recent years, I've bought myself a very nice condition hardcover version of it. And it takes pride of place on one of my bookshelves here in the study where I record Who Wars. And as a kid, you know, you absorb so much information when you read books like that. And to me, it's just, even though it has errors, even though it's not complete, it only goes up to around the time of the Five Doctors, even though it, you know, you can poke all sorts of holes in it, it remains for me a very, very important book. And I think this book, The Doctor, His Lives and Times, could also be that kind of book for a child today who might be, you know, still interested in reading. I know a lot of kids would rather be playing on their tablets or PCs or PlayStations or whatever. But for those kids out there who do like to read and who can sit down with a book and just absorb information until it comes out of their ears, I think this is almost the modern version of something like Doctor Who, A Celebration. In fact, this has tons and tons and tons more information than Doctor Who, A Celebration. Funnily enough, when you flick to the bibliography at the back of the book, Doctor Who, A Celebration and some of the other Peter Haining books are some of the key sources for this book. So I know when I was flicking through and reading certain quotes, I thought, oh, I know that quote. Where have I heard that before? Was it in Doctor Who magazine, maybe? And maybe it was, because Doctor Who magazine is obviously a source as well. But I think an awful lot of stuff in here does come from Doctor Who, A Celebration, so it just goes to show how this stuff gets recycled decades and decades on. Anyway, I'm going to open the book here and talk about some of the interesting things I noticed when I first got the book and turned to the contents page. And that's although the book is attributed to James Goss and Steve Tribe, and James Goss, just by the by, wrote the first of the new series adventure novels I read recently and reviewed on Who Wars, called The Blood Cell. Although it's attributed to these two chaps, there are a lot of people who have contributed pieces, small pieces, to the book. And just as you start to look down the contents page, you see Mark Gatiss is talking about An Unearthly Child. Bernard Cribbins is talking about Dalek's Invasion of Earth 2150 AD. Obviously, he was in the film version of that. Sir Tim Berners-Lee, the father of the internet, talks about the War Machines. Neil Gaiman talks about Tomb of the Cybermen. Nicholas Briggs talks about Inferno. Paul Cornell on Horror of Fang Rock. Andrew Smith talks about the Ribos operation. Nicola Bryant, or Perry, from the 80s series of Doctor Who, talks about Full Circle. That was a story I had to turn to and was wondering, why on earth is Nicola Bryant talking about Full Circle? But that was an interesting kind of story. Mark Platt talks about Snake Dance. Dan Starkey talks about the two Doctors. Obviously a bit of a Sontaran influence there, and I'll actually read his piece in a moment. And look, it just goes on and on. Gary Russell on Ghostlight, Paul McGann himself talks about the Eighth Doctor. Colin Baker talks about The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances, so there you have an older Doctor talking about stories from the modern series, and so on and so forth. And as you flick through the book, and it goes through each Doctor, the First Doctor, the Second Doctor, and so on, there are a lot of pieces of writing in here. Some of it is creative writing, like it's taken from a diary, or during the Fifth Doctor part of the book, it seems to be an interview between River Song and Tegan Jovanka. You know, have you ever thought of maybe River Song talking to Tegan? Well, that happens in this book. And so you have all these bits of creative writing, and then you have more factual type pieces, like talking about different eras of the show, different quotes from people about the show, and that's where a lot of those comments from, say, Doctor Who A Celebration come into it. You know, they've been culled for those sections. And even just strange little advertisements, like I've turned to a page here, and it's an advertisement for a mechanoid. You know, if you think back to the Patrick Troughton adventures, it says, "Hail our robot explorers, it's space exploration made easy with the all-new mechanoid," and it's a 60s kind of advert for mechanoids. You know, it's fun stuff. I mean, I think some of it would go over the head of someone who's, I don't know, 12 years old today and hasn't seen a lot of classic era Doctor Who. This could be very strange stuff. But I always like to think that's the kind of stuff that the smart child out there will reach up and grasp. I like to, if I think of myself as being a smart child back in the day, that's the kind of stuff that I would read, you know, perhaps something about a William Hartnell story that I'd never seen, never read the Target novel. But I would reach up and I would go and read the Target novel, or I'd try and learn more about the story. And in between, I would be just fascinated with hearing about and seeing pictures of these things that I had no sort of reference point for. So although obviously a great deal of this book is about the past, I think for a smart child this could be a very, very good book. Now, I mentioned I'd read out the Dan Starkey piece about the two Doctors, but I thought before I do that, I might just turn to a couple of random pages and just tell you what's on it, because honestly, when I look at this book, I can't even begin to choose like sections to talk about in detail, because there's just so much information. So look, let's just turn to a random page, and it's the Fourth Doctor, and talking of like advertisements and things like that, there is like a sign for the Pharos Project Visitor Centre. "We regret that the Visitor Centre and gift shop are currently closed for technical reasons. Also, the lecture Bubble Memory Forecasting the Future with Computers, scheduled for March 5th, has been postponed due to unforeseen circumstances." So obviously a little in-joke there about it all being closed because of the kerfuffle that went on in Legopolis, perhaps. There's a letter on Ferris Project note paper. "Dear Sir, I am writing to protest in the strongest terms that the actions of a group originating, we believe, from your establishment. A protest march is one thing, but a bunch of kids from the Polytechnic running around claiming to be aliens and even making off with an ambulance is quite another. Shocking and shameful behaviour. If this is undergraduate humour, then I fail to see the funny side." And that letter goes on for several more paragraphs. obviously relating to Tegan and Nyssa and Adric during the events of Legopolis. So that's a funny thing. Let's turn to another random page. We're in the fifth Doctor section here. And what have we got? Well, as it turns out, we've turned to part of the River Song and Tegan Jovanka interview. So I'll just read a random part of this. Dr. Song, did you have a plan? Any idea what you were going to do next? Tegan Jovanka, no, perhaps I expected the Doctor to come running after me. Ah, she's talking about the end of Resurrection of the Daleks, obviously. It's what any human man would do if he cared. But he didn't. Perhaps that settled it. Perhaps it didn't. And I stood there in the rain, looking out at the grey river, the grey sky, the grey buildings, home of a sort, and I wondered if I hadn't made a terrible mistake. I ran back to the warehouse, and as I ran in, I heard for the last time ever the sound of the TARDIS fading away for good. Braveheart, Doctor. And so this is the kind of creative writing I was talking about, the kind of interviews I was talking about, you know, obviously tying into actual TV episodes there. Let's do one more. And I flicked forward to the 8th Doctor. Oh no, it's the 7th Doctor. Sylvester McCoy was the 7th Doctor. And we have a breakout box saying, McCoy on McCoy. And it's a bunch of quotes here. I didn't have a sonic screwdriver, I had an umbrella, from Sylvester McCoy. My Doctor, well, he's kind of Chaplin-esque in many ways. Buster Keaton, mixed with something rather darker, more mysterious. He didn't start off fully formed. He came out of the womb, the TARDIS, a more comedic character. I wasn't given much guidance, really, which was great in a way, because I had to find my own feet. And so on and so forth. Now, I mentioned reading the Dan Starkey piece on the two Doctors, so bear with me. It runs... One big difference between the classic series and its modern incarnation is a greater willingness to show death on screen. The Two Doctors is quite exceptional in this, not just in its body count, but in the sheer grisly relish with which it depicts various characters' demises. There are at least three graphic stabbings. The story's villainess tastes the Doctor's blood, still warm as she scrapes it off the floor. An old lady is karate chopped to death by a vicious alien chef whose motivation throughout the story is to get his first taste of human flesh. And the Doctor suffocates this aspirant cannibal with a cyanide-soaked hanky. The senior Sontaran is betrayed by his allies and suffers a prolonged threefold death. He's gassed by acid vapor, then fried by a sabotaged time machine, before finally limping in agony to his spacecraft, only to be blown to pieces by a concealed bomb. His severed leg is then brought in, dripping with green blood. As violent demises go, Strax would no doubt heartily approve. And of course, for those of you who don't realise, Dan Starkey, who's writing this, plays Strax in the modern Doctor Who episodes. These Sontarans are quite physically different from their predecessors, and really quite tall. Sartorially, they stand out too, their armour having acquired a spangly sheen. I don't envy the actors wearing those costumes under the heat of the Andalusian sun, nor their prosthetics, which look heavier and less flexible than the ones I wear. I've been in danger of overheating in my Sontaran suit on a rainy location shoot in... And he's named a Welsh town here, which I won't even attempt to say out loud. So I can't imagine how it must have been for them in Spain. When I watched this story at the age of 7, the Sontarans were imprinted on my mind as one of the top tier of the Doctor's enemies. Little did I realise that one day I would be donning that collar and potato head myself for some glorious warfare of my own. And there we go. So, to summarise, this book... I think would really suit a younger Doctor Who fan, but an intelligent younger Doctor Who fan who wants to read about stuff, particularly stuff they haven't seen or encountered before, and to really reach up and grab what else is out there. For an older fan like myself, a lot of the quotes, as I mentioned, are from books that I liked when I was a kid, when I was 12 years old. So when I'm reading through the quote sections, I'm going, oh yeah, I've heard that, I've heard that, I've heard that, and I've heard that. And it was either from A Celebration or 25 Glorious Years or from Doctor Who magazine back in the day or whatever the case might be. So there's less value in it for me in that sense. I do enjoy these newer pieces that have been written, like the Dan Starkey piece there, like Mark Gatiss talking about An Unearthly Child, and of course Nicola Bryant talking about Full Circle. If you want the insight on that, basically she had Andrew Smith over to her house who had written Full Circle, and some other chap who I think had been an actor in it as well, and they said, have you ever seen Full Circle? She said no. Apparently her stepson quite liked it. Next thing, the DVD's on, and she ended up watching Full Circle with its writer and one of the actors, and she's written a little piece about that in the book. So there are interesting and new things that I've never heard before, make no mistake, but overall, I don't think this is really the kind of book that I would run out and buy at $50. But for $10, for something that I'm going to flick through and pull out a few new anecdotes and see a few pictures, I must admit, that I haven't seen before or have seen so rarely that I've forgotten them. There are some really nice pictures in here too. It's a great little thing. So Doctor Who, His Lives and Times, I think if you get out there and can find it for a discounted price or a second-hand price, perhaps on eBay or something, it might be well worth putting up on your shelf alongside, I hope, some other Doctor Who reference books, perhaps even Doctor Who A Celebration, which I still heartily recommend all these years on. All right, let me know if you do end up buying it too. You can write into Who Wars at hello@whowars.net and send me an email about it, or even record an MP3 and give me your own thoughts on this book.
Fantastic! Oh, fantastic!
Okay then, so here we are looking at Doctor Who, the Ninth Doctor comic, issue number 3 from Titan Comics. And as with all my reviews, this is going to be very spoilerific because I love talking about what actually happens in books and comics that I read. So if you've not read this comic and you want to read this comic before you hear all about it from someone like me, then I would turn off now or fast forward or do something because I'm about to talk about it all. Okay, the first thing to note when I opened up this comic book is my immediate feeling of, gosh, what's been happening in this? How long has it been since we last looked at the Ninth Doctor comics? And it was actually 11 episodes ago in Who Wars 27 that we looked at issue 1, and it was 4 episodes ago in Who Wars 34 that we looked at issue 2. Now, given we're a fortnightly podcast, it doesn't take Einstein to work out that that is 22 weeks ago we looked at the first issue and 8 weeks ago that we looked at the second issue. And I really don't know what's happening with this comic book, why it's on this weird sort of time schedule where it just sort of comes out when it wants to come out. I don't understand that. I have no insight into that. But it certainly makes it hard to sort of stay in motion with the story, if I can put it that way. I mean, it's sometimes hard when comics come out monthly on the dot. But here, you know, to think back to the first issue 22 weeks ago, it's just really hard to sort of stay on track. Fortunately, there's these recaps at the start of the Titan comics, and that helped to remind me, I guess, just how much I really didn't like the first issue, which was awkward because when I did that review, we had just spoken to the writer of the comic on the same podcast. Awkward. But to go over that briefly, you had these two races, the Unon and the Lect, having a fight. The Doctor, Rose, and Captain Jack got involved in the middle of the fight and spent all the issue running around, getting captured and escaping until Rose was lost to the time vortex at the end of the issue. It was a very run-around, very light kind of issue. It didn't really go anywhere for me. Fortunately, the second issue was a lot better. The Doctor and Jack tracked down Rose to a bazaar, you know, a place where they're selling all kinds of things, particularly illegal weapons. And this bazaar is being held in a time bubble because just outside the time bubble is a big supernova that would absolutely obliterate the bazaar if the time bubble wasn't there. And this issue was quite interesting because the Doctor found all sorts of Gallifreyan artifacts and weapons from the Time War. He got very angry about that, and I thought, oh gosh, the story has really opened up. This is really exciting stuff. I really genuinely enjoyed issue number 2. But then we get here to issue number 3, and we seem to have gone back to a wild mishmash of what was happening in issue number 1, because essentially what happens is the Unon and the Lect start having a fight again, and the Doctor, Jack, and Rose are caught up in it again. And what happens here is the Doctor, who is wanting to communicate with the Unon in particular, gets zapped by what appears to be a death ray. You know, his outline is all obliterated and goes black. It looks like he's been blown away. Unfortunately, though, with a series like Doctor Who, where you know the lead isn't going to die, it's hard to believe that anything bad has happened. And my first thought was, well, he's been teleported somewhere. And then my second thought was, gosh, didn't we do that at the end of the first Eccleston series on TV? And isn't that a bit weird to have this comic book with the Ninth Doctor and Rose, and instead of Rose getting zapped like she got zapped in the Weakest Link game show, here we have the Doctor getting zapped and getting teleported somewhere else. It's, I hate to use the word lazy, but when it's the Doctor and Rose doing something in a comic book that's already been done on television, I just think, gosh, there may have been better ways to do this, but I digress. The Doctor gets teleported away to meet the leader of the Unon, who he starts having a conversation with. Meanwhile, Rose and Captain Jack are still at the bazaar, dodging the lasers, hoping not to get blown up. Some of the people from the bazaar decide to steal the TARDIS. The Lector wanting to get inside the TARDIS. You wonder, where's all this going to go? Because, of course, with all this fighting breaking out, the time bubble that protects the bazaar is going to disappear within 10 minutes. Of course it is. So, what happens? Well, Jack does something tricky with his vortex manipulator, and another version of him ends up on the TARDIS, to which he opens the door and can see the other version of himself and Rose outside. He's beckoning them to come into the TARDIS, but all hell breaks loose. The time bubble bursts, and we assume that everyone is obliterated. So again, harking back to that first issue, you've just got the Unon and the Lect fighting, our heroes involved in the middle of it, and the issue ends not with Rose being lost to the time vortex this time, but Rose being lost to a supernova. Rose and Captain Jack, or at least one version of him, that is. So I guess this is preparing us for something interesting that's going to happen in the fourth issue of the comic. Perhaps it's all the even numbers of this comic are the good ones and the odd ones are the bad ones. Sort of to plagiarise that old Star Trek saying where they used to say it was the odd movies that were the good movies. Or was it the even ones? I don't know. I'm not a Trekkie. Kate, help me out here. So yeah, that's where we are with this story. In issue one had a ropey sort of tale. In issue two, it got very interesting. In issue three, we sort of harkened back to the first issue again. Let's hope that something interesting happens in issue number four, because I do enjoy the artwork. I do enjoy the dialogue. I can absolutely believe Christopher Eccleston saying some of these lines. Some of the panels, too, are quite good. You know, close-ups on the Doctor's face or where he's floating through a void after being zapped. He's floating upside down, the look on his face. It's very interesting. It's very Eccleston. There's that Eccleston kind of humour from the first series of Doctor Who. The kind of humour, by the way, that Christopher Eccleston wishes he hadn't overdone now when he talks about Doctor Who, but I digress. It's here in the comic, and it's very fitting. It's exactly what happened in series one of Doctor Who. It's exactly how they did the comedy. So it all fits. It's just that the story is it's just a bit ropey. Anyway, I look forward to issue number four of The Ninth Doctor. I don't know when it will come out. Maybe another 8 weeks from now. Who knows? It's not us being slack here at Who Wars. It's just that this comic is taking its own sweet time. Oh, before I go, I will mention there was a nice panel in this comic too where the Ninth Doctor is thinking back to the Time War, and there's a nice depiction of the War Doctor and also the Eighth Doctor in sort of his more dishevelled Time War sort of guys. I'm wondering whether that might tie into the Four Doctors book that Titan's putting out, but probably not. That was just a random thought from me. It's a nice panel, though, nevertheless. Anyway, are you reading the Titan comics? Are you into these? Have you been reading the Ninth Doctor in particular? Are we on the same page, no pun intended, with where these comics are at, i.e. the first one was ropey, the second one was good, and now the third one, I think, has gone a bit ropey again. It's not quite as ropey as the first one, but it is certainly ropey. Here's hoping number four is a good one. Anyway, that's my review for this time around. I'll see you at some stage in the future to talk about issue number four.
Hello, Alan's here. I should say Alan's here, more like Alan's here. Look sharp, Rose Tyler, Alan's here. And then, it'd be really brilliant if I met someone called Alonzo, because then I could say Alan's here, Alonzo, every time.
So, I haven't exactly been thrilled with the last two issues of Titan's Doctor Who 10th Doctor series. So has this new issue, number 13, changed my mind? Well, stay tuned and find out. So, like I said, this is issue number 13. It's called Spiral Staircase Part 1, which is kind of interesting because it's more like a Part 3. It's a continuation of the last two stories, so that's kind of different how they're numbering these, but we've got the same crew, Nick Abadzis, Elena Casagrande, and then Hi-Fi for the colorist, who you can hear me interview in the Phoenix Comic-Con special, by the way. So there's a really interesting cover. It's got the Doctor in the foreground. He's trapped in some sort of ray shield with lightning and stuff. It kind of reminds me of when Count Dooku is holding Obi-Wan Kenobi captive, you know, and he can't move or anything, and he's just kind of suspended. And then you got the girls, Gabby and Cindy behind him, kind of like, they look kind of angry almost, like they're running towards him and yelling. And then they're all surrounded by just like rubble and ruins of the city. And the variant is pretty cool. It's the 10th Doctor standing right on the Brooklyn Bridge. So it's a photograph of the Brooklyn Bridge. So that's pretty cool. Now the main characters as featured on the inside cover are the Doctor, Gabby, and Dorothy Bell. Why don't I just go ahead and read the previously portion on here? It's pretty good. Leaving Gabby to make amends with Cindy, the Doctor discovered an unearthly device in the heart of Manhattan capable of triggering rejuvenation. The Doctor tracked the device to the apartment of actress Dorothy Bell, dogged every step of the way by street-smart Agent Cleo. Having seized the artifact at Bell's home, Cleo unleashed a fraction of its power before fleeing back to her employers, Eric and Hanif, leaving Dorothy, her assistant, Vivian, and the Doctor in a state of retro-regeneration. But the artifact restored more than a healthy, youthful glow to Dorothy. She merged with the mysterious alien entity within, and is now drawing a strange extraterrestrial power toward Earth. Okay, so I thought that was a really good recap, actually. It helped to clear a few things up in my mind anyway, so that's kind of telling about the last few issues. So yeah, Dorothy's merged with this alien entity, and she's glowing, and she can fly now, and she apparently has the ability to use matter transmutation to rebuild things, and so she's kind of taken this mission upon herself to make things better as she sees fit. So the first thing she goes to fix is the hospital where they were going to build a wing in her honor. We find out the mysterious organization is actually a cult, and they are awaiting the ascension, and they're just, you know, they don't really know what's going on, but they are expecting some sort of god or something to return, and there's going to be this ascension, they believe. Eventually, this mysterious organization, they join forces with the Doctor, and they chase down Dorothy. In the meantime, Dorothy has really taken a liking to Gabby, and she actually, like, takes her and flies off with her. And so she decides that the Empire State Building needs about 20 more floors. So she transmutates the Empire State Building, and eventually she just kind of goes on this spree of fixing the whole city. And it's just like total chaos. And, you know, there's even one of the Hallmark Doctor Who news stories talking about all this rebuilding going on in the town and what's happening and blah, blah, blah. And in the midst of all this chaos, you see that mysterious dark spaceship has actually landed in New York. And the last frame we see is the Doctor and Cindy actually disappearing. And then it's to be continued. So yeah, I thought this issue was pretty interesting. Probably about the same level as the last one. A little more than two issues ago. But, you know, we get to find out a little more about some of this stuff. But still, it's like so mysterious. And it's kind of driving me crazy because I like to know things. Hopefully, we'll find out even more in the next issue. Who's behind the spaceship? Who exactly is Cleo? More about this alien entity that's merged with Dorothy. If by the end of this story arc we don't find out more answers, I'm going to be really upset. Now, the art, yeah, I don't really have anything bad to say about the art. It's kind of some interesting scenes with New York City because they look a little bit just, rather than just traditionally painted or whatever, they look kind of, you know, maybe just filtered in Photoshop. So it would have been kind of nice maybe to have that more consistent. And one thing I did like was the lettering. And so special shout out to the letterers, Richard Starkings and Comic Crafts Jimmy Bentecourt. I really liked the lettering because, you know, with Dorothy and the merged entity, it was different text for when they were talking. So you could tell who was saying what. Okay, so like when she's at the hospital and she's getting ready to do the remodeling. So Dorothy says, let's do it the way I've always wanted it done. So there's this other little bubble with different text, and I imagine it would sound something like this. Enhancements in progress. And so I thought that was just a really neat way to differentiate the different speech patterns from these characters, even though they're merged into one. So that was pretty cool. Overall, I'll give this 7 Sonic Screwdrivers out of 10. I think that's what I gave the last issue. It was about pretty similar to that. So let's hope for the Spiral Staircase Part 2 that it really picks up and we get some more answers. That's what I'm hoping for. All right. Later, guys. Allons-y, and may the Force be with you.
Well, here we are at the end of the 38th Who Wars. My thanks, as always, to the team for putting together such great features and reviews and interviews. Kate, your interview with Matthew Jacobs was just sublime, I've got to say. Possibly your best interview yet. In fact, probably your best interview yet, I would say. All right, that's all I have to say about this episode per se, aside from the fact that if you're out there listening through iTunes, and we know you're out there because we see how many people download each episode and we see what percentage of you have iTunes, it would be great if you could leave us a rating or review on iTunes so that other people like yourselves can find us and tune in and hear all these great interviews and features that we're putting together. That would mean a lot to us. All right, moving on to the fortnightly comment, or the back page, as I like to call it here at the end of these episodes. And this time around, I want to talk about Colin Baker, the Sixth Doctor. He appeared in an interview earlier in this episode. He was in an interview in episode 36. He's a friend of the show almost, isn't he? Well, in the recent Doctor Who magazine, you may have seen him talking about Doctor Who magazine polls. And Colin has actually boycotted the magazine for a little while, in part because of these polls, where the magazine not only shows you who the most favourite Doctor is according to the people they polled, but show every Doctor right down to the least favourite, and Colin Baker is invariably, unfortunately, down the bottom of that list. And I've got to say, not for the audios. For the audios, he's actually quite a popular Doctor, but in terms of TV Doctors, he often comes down the bottom of these polls, and he had a little bit of a tanty to say that he wishes the polls just showed, you know, maybe the favourite Doctor or the favourite few Doctors, and the rest of the Doctors maybe could be left alone and not shown in a pecking order. He actually said this in the interview back in episode 36. He tends to see the Doctor as one character, so how do you split off, oh, I like this one more than that one? They are essentially still the one character at the end of the day. And I know there's a lot of people out there talking about this, a lot of people with opinions. I know J.R. Southall from the Blue Box podcast was commenting on Facebook recently on one side of the debate, and I know others of you out there probably agree with Colin's point of view as well. And it got me thinking, where do I stand on this? And in some ways, I tend to agree with Colin, not from the point of view that Doctors shouldn't see where they are in the pecking order. I think that's a little bit soft. I think, you know, if you've been a Doctor on TV, it's like having been a James Bond on film or another iconic character. You've been a character that very few people will ever be, so even if you're bottom of the list, you're still bottom of a fairly exclusive list. I guess it's like saying George Lazenby is the least favourite James Bond, perhaps, because he was only in one and people didn't rate him. I actually quite like him as James Bond, as an aside. He's an Australian, did you know that? Anyway, I'm digressing. I do think people can harden up a bit. I think Colin should probably harden up a little. But that said, in the past, and particularly when Doctor Who magazine has done polls of classic era stories and tried to rate every story from top to bottom, these are the ones that show us, you know, that Caves of Androzani is, you know, perpetually one of the most popular stories, and that Twin Dilemma is one of the least popular, and so on. I'm not sure how often they're doing those, whether it's yearly or bi-yearly or every 5 years now or whatever it might be, but I've been reading Doctor Who magazine since 1986 and I've seen it done a few times. And quite often I've thought, polls like this are a little bit anal, if I can put it that way. Maybe, if I can put it another way, a little bit Doctor Who fanish. You know, a little bit OCD, a little bit needing to say, this is better than this, and this one sits next to this one on the shelf, and this one goes here, and that one goes there. And I've never really seen the point myself, from the point of view, and maybe this is my old statistics training coming back to me from my days at university. But maybe this comes from the point of view that I know not many people vote in Doctor Who magazine polls. Doctor Who magazine doesn't have a huge readership to begin with, and not everyone who reads it votes in these polls. Again, I've been reading since 1986, and I have never, ever, ever voted in one of the polls. And whenever I've seen poll results, particularly when they've done, you know, favourite shows in the classic era, I've always thought, how many people voted in this? Was it in the low thousands? Was it in the high hundreds? I don't know. But when you have, you know, so many stories and you stretch them right out on this big line and say, look, way down that end, that's the most popular, and way down that end, that's the least popular. But it's based on such a tiny amount of votes overall, the sample is so small, I kind of can't get behind the results. I mean, I know technically they're right, that this percentage of the people who wrote in said this one, and this percentage of people who wrote in said that one, but it's such a small percentage of people overall, I'm not quite sure what it all means. You know, if you look and say, this story is the 51st most popular story, but that story is the 57th most popular story. What does that even mean? You know, in those situations, I tend to think maybe just knowing the top 5 or top 10 stories might be the go. I mean, if you're being particularly sadistic, maybe you could do the top 10 stories and the bottom 10 stories, but to know what comes in between and in the particular order they came in, it's just that wee bit anal. It's just that wee bit obsessive. It's just that wee bit Doctor Who fanish. And although I am a massive Doctor Who fan, look, I'm sitting here making a podcast about it, although I'm a complete ferret for Doctor Who and have been since I was a little kid, even I can't get interested in that. I don't see the point. I've never seen the point. So there are elements of what Colin's saying that I kind of agree with, not, I hasten to add, for the reasons that he's giving, but for my own reasons. And, you know, it's a little different, I guess, when it comes to talking about the most recent series, because there's only, you know, a certain number of programs and a certain number of writers and so on. But for the broader stuff, like who was your favourite Doctor of all time, and what are your favourite stories from the classic era, and those bigger, more far-reaching polls, to publish results based on such small samples of respondents, I'm just not sure it's right. And, yeah. Anyway, what do you think? Did you see these comments by Colin Baker? Did they make you think a certain way on one side or the other? Did you side with Colin? Did you side with his detractors? Have you read Doctor Who magazine for a long time like myself and maybe thought other thoughts about it like I have? Who knows? Why not write in and tell us at hello@whowars.net, and you can send that as a simple email and I'll read it out, or you can record yourself as an MP3 and I'll play that on the show. We'd really love to hear your feedback. Anyway, that's my thoughts on the Colin Baker issue, and that's the end of episode 38 of Who Wars. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you again in a fortnight's time. Of course, we've got Cloud City Council next Sunday. Robert will be back hosting with Jonathan again, and I'm sure they'll be talking about some great Star Wars comics and Star Wars news in general. So if that's your bag, why not tune in and have a listen to that? But we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. We've got some great stuff up our sleeves, and maybe I'll drop some hints on Twitter as the weeks go by to let you know what that might be. All right, people, take care of yourselves. I'm Rob Irwin, and I'll see you next time.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.